We have a wonderful special kind of worship planned around music, and which starts with Take the A Train. Dorothy, could you just stand for a second so people can see you? Dorothy is our special guest this morning, and it was her idea for this service. She is a former diplomat. Served in at the United Nations as an assistant to Madeleine Albright. And I thought when she approached me, it was going to be something around the theme of the United Nations, but it was a completely different idea that Dorothy had for a worship service, and it has turned out to be wonderful. So let's have a seat and let's talk about this a little bit. So Dorothy, when you came to talk to me, you told me this incredible story about how as a young person, you went to an NAACP, National Conference, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, National Conference in 1969, and they said, we are in serious financial difficulty. And then you were thinking about this as a young person and decided you wanted to do something. Roy Wilson was executive director. Tell the story.
Yes, I went to Mr. Wilkins, and I was very, it was very sad for me because I'd been very active with the NAACP all my life, as a teenager as well. I wanted to make sure that we could continue the work that we were doing, and I told him that I had an idea that I thought I could make a contribution to the funds and we would be able to stay open. So he smiled. He didn't really believe me, but he finally said, okay, what do you think you can do, and tell me what you want me to do, because we have no money. And do you have money? And I said, no, I don't have any either. So he said, how are you going to do this? I said, well, I have an idea, and I think I can make it work. And I told him about the idea of doing a tribute to Duke Ellington, America's greatest composer. And he thought that would be a wonderful thing if I could do it. So he gave me an office space and a secretary. And the next week, I set up and started to go on my course of what I had to do to set this into motion. The first thing, of course, was to meet the Duke Ellington family. So I knew Ruth Ellington, and I called her and told her, and she had me come over and talk. And then we talked. She called Duke, and she told him, and he is such a gracious, kind, pleasant, loving person. He laughed first, but he was so excited. So he came over, and we talked. And then he asked me about the Duke Ellington Society. Was I aware of it? I had never heard of the Duke Ellington Society. And it appears that there was the Duke Ellington Society, a very large organization. And all of these people were just in love with Duke Ellington and his music. They followed him everywhere. So he introduced me to the president of the Duke Ellington Society, and he got very excited, and the organization decided that they would walk me through the life of Duke Ellington so that I could get into character and get to know what I'm really trying to do. And I spent every Monday morning in the president's home of the Duke Ellington Society's home down in Greenwich Village. And we talked, and they told me all the wonderful things that I needed to know about Duke Ellington and all the bad things that I need to know about Duke Ellington. So I really began to love all of this. So I decided I needed someone else to help me, and I went and found a friend of mine who was an executive with entertainment manager. And
So your basic idea was to raise money for the NAACP by having a tribute concert to Duke Ellington at Madison Square Garden in New York City, and you conceived of this idea without having any money.
That's right.
Right.
So, I was trying to skip over that because it doesn't sound feasible to even to think that.
Well, it makes it a better story, though, and it's true.
And also the fact that I was charging $100 the tickets for the concert, and that had never been heard of in New York. People charge $100 for a concert.
But it was for a good cause.
But it was for a good cause, and everybody that I spoke to, when I said the word Duke Ellington and NAACP, I never got a rejection. Everyone. Always was interested in being part of it.
So I interrupted your narration. You went to your friend who was a promoter?
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, before that, while I was meeting with the Duke Ellington Society every Monday evening, I contacted Lloyd Richards, who was the drama professor at Yale, and to come with me and to work with me to put this program over so that he would write the entire program once I had gotten the stars together. So finally, in the final production, we had more than 20 stars really performing for free. No one was paid a dime, not one dime. The only money that was paid to Madison Square Garden, because they would not give us the place for free, and that was $31,000 that we needed. We had absolutely $0.
So how did you get the $31,000?
Well, I have a lot of friends in Wall Street and in New York and also and a lot of friends in retailing, because I was in retailing for a short while. And so I had the CEOs of all the big companies and all the banks become sponsors to this program. Once you said the word Duke Ellington, nobody said no. So that's how we got the money. But my co-chair was Ira Haupt, who is very, very a big man on Wall Street, and he was also a member of the national board of the NAACP. So he was very concerned about making sure that we could do this. And one day, when he was walking his dog one night after work, his friend from Chemical Bank, the president of Chemical Bank, was there walking his dog, and he told him that he was very sad because he needed $31,000 by tomorrow morning, and he just didn't have it. So the so the banker said to him, "Well, Ira, you should have told me. I could have sent a check over." And so he said, "Come in tomorrow and pick up the check." And that's how we really got so it.
The lesson is, get a dog, go for a walk, talk to your neighbors.
Just get a dog and go for a walk, yeah. And so after that, it was my responsibility to contact all of these entertainers from Sammy Davis Jr., Tony Bennett, Peggy Lee, all of them. Everybody that I could think of, everybody that I thought knew Duke Ellington. And they were all very, very excited about the idea of doing a tribute to Duke Ellington. So Sammy Davis was the most difficult person because his people did not want me to talk to him. So I could never really get to him. But my Wall Street friend said, he's going to be at the Deauville in Miami. I'm going to give you money to go there and you talk to him while you're there. And that's what I did. I went down to the Deauville. I took my girlfriend with me and the two of us. And we were sort of cute young girls at that time. And so I called Sammy on the phone and he picked up the phone in his suite. And I told him what I wanted. And he said, well, why don't you come up and talk to me? And when I came up, he said, oh my goodness. I thought you were going to be some little old lady and said, Mr. Davis, I want you to work with the NAACP. And he was making a big scene out of it. And so, when he saw that we had these little mini skirts on, and he was just, he said, sit down. I think this sounds interesting. So he ended up being the MC for the program. And he did very, very well. So that was how we were able to put this program over. But the most important part and interesting part about the entire program for me was what I learned. It was almost as if I were in school talking to the members of the Duke Ellington Society every Monday night in the same home, in the same place, and the fellows making the food, and we just sat around and talked, and they told me about their experiences with Duke and how Duke has suffered so much, his band, through the segregation in this country. And every time they would travel throughout the country, Duke could never stay in a hotel. The band could never stay in a hotel. They had to sleep in the cars. And these members of the Duke Ellington Society would travel with them, sleep in the cars with them, because they loved him so much, they didn't want him to get discouraged. And that went on for years until the Civil Rights Act of 1965. So I learned an awful lot about Duke Ellington and about the people that really loved him and did everything they could to make him continue with his talent. He was a great composer, and I think one of the statements that they said that I think is very true, they talked about how he was perfect, he had perfect balance between composition and improvisation, and the greatest combination to development of jazz, and that's why I guess he's considered the greatest jazz composer. He really is considered one of the greatest American composers between all of them, and including Berlin and Copland and others that we know so much about. So I enjoyed being able to work with them and talk with them. I enjoyed because they shared the seriousness of Duke Ellington's greatness and how he was so concerned and so disturbed about the treatment of African Americans in this country and around the world. And many of his recordings was dealt with that, and especially the one Black, Brown, and Beige. He never spoke out publicly about his feelings about discrimination, but he did it through his music. And that was what made him such a special person to me, because that was always one of my interests in my years in NAACP. And through the civil rights movement. I was very militant when I wasn't a nice little quiet. I was very militant. So, and I was very concerned about what was happening in our country. And I did enjoy very much meeting with Tom Harris and Tom Ten. And Tom Harris passed away about 3 months ago. And I'm a member of the Duke Ellington Society now, and the society now has a Black president. They never had Black members or presidents during that time. But now they are still going, and there's a lot of older people still very, very into the Duke Ellington Society. And Tom DeTeen, he was the president when I did this, and he is still alive. He's about 99 or something. But when they heard that we were going to do this in the church here, they were thrilled. They were so, and so everybody wanted to get in on it and have something to say, and so I tried to repeat some of the nice things that they said. My question to them was, why did everybody like Duke Ellington so? He said because they really thought they knew him because he put his best foot forward whenever he was in public. He was always a very elegant man. He was very handsome, and he was always had a happy face, and that's true. When I met him, he said to me, I want you to be by my side so you can learn all you need to know about me. And he invited me to all of his concerts, to be present at all of his concerts in New York, and I truly enjoyed that. So, and they went on to tell me about a lot of things that they experienced working with him and the problems that he had when he tried to get a concert into Carnegie Hall, and they turned him down for Benny Goodman. And then years later, in 1993, they let him come to Carnegie Hall. He had a filled house, and they were very pleased, and everybody was so excited until Duke took off, and around the world he went and became one of the greatest jazz artists in the world. So those are the things that I truly enjoyed learning because I did not know anything about him, and I didn't even realize know why Nixon really wanted to honor him the way that he did at the White House. But getting to know him and being part of this was one of the nicest things, that, and it should happen once to everyone.
I'd like to ask you, Dorothy, you were invited by the family to attend
yes.
the memorial service when he died in 1974.
Yes, I was invited to attend, but before I go into that, I'd just like to read the statement from the president of the Duke Ellington Society to this group today. He said, as composer, neither Gershman, Berlin, nor Copeland could come close to him. Edward Kennedy Ellington was truly a man for all seasons. His legacy stands alone. Today, he would be 114 years old. His work withstood the test of time, and as we listen to his music, we are still learning and hearing something new. That's true. Nearly every year, the Abraham Lincoln, a new book is written and is published, and also every year a new book is written and published with Duke Ellington. To me, that is what real greatness is. As president of the Duke Ellington Society, I feel obligated, especially to the youth, to keep this legacy alive. The big bands are gone. The dancing has changed, and the marketing of music has greatly lessened the appreciation of Mastro's music. It is for this reason that I feel there is still a lot of work to be done. As a child, he was given the title Duke by a peer. As Duke, he became an American ambassador who traveled more than 5 million miles and composed more than any American composer. Duke Ellington is known, and that's the end of his remarks, he's known for having composed at least 1,600 pieces. And so when Duke Ellington died in 1975, I was invited by the family to sit with the family at the memorial service at St. John's Divine. And the church was filled with 12,500 people, honoring America's greatest composer of American music, jazz. Duke Ellington composed over 1,600 musical compositions. He received honorary degrees and national, international, and national awards. The moment at the closing of the memorial, there was a hush over the church, and the great Ella Fitzgerald appeared and began to sing. In my solitude, you haunt me with reveries, days gone by.
In my solitude, you taught me with memories that never die. I sit in my chair, I'm filled with despair. No one should be so sad. With gloom everywhere, I sit and I stare. Someday I know I'll go mad. In my solitude, I'm praying, dear Lord above, send back my love. In my solitude, I'm praying, dear Lord above, send back my
Edward Kennedy Ellington, born April 29, 1899, in Washington, D.C. He was the first grandson on his mother's side, and he was pampered and spoiled by all the women in the family, aunts and female cousins alike. One of his cousins said, "We were so happy to see him. We thought he was the grandest thing in the world." His mother, Daisy, was an attractive woman. She had rigorous moral principles, and she was dignified in her conduct and disapproving of anything improper. In the family system, Daisy was the queen, and son Edward was the crown prince. He said, when he was a little boy sitting in his mother's lap, he looked into her face and knew she was the most beautiful mother in the world. Well, Daisy Ellington was a religious woman and an avid churchgoer. Every Sunday, she took her son to two churches on Sunday morning. The first, the 19th Street Baptist Church, where her family worshiped. This church had been founded in 1802. Members included both whites and their African-American servants originally. But as time passed, other African-American persons were accepted into the congregation. And in 1833, the white members left, establishing what is now called First Baptist Church, while 40 African-American members remained in what became known as 19th Street Baptist Church, which eventually moved to 16th Street but retained the name 19th Street Baptist Church. It was the first church that Barack Obama attended when he moved to Washington with his family as President of the United States. It was so chaotic when he was there that the security was so intense that they decided, in the interest of the health of the church, that they would not attend there on a regular basis. Well, each Sunday, after taking her son to the Baptist church, Daisy Ellington took him to church of her husband's family, which was called John Wesley African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church on 14th Street. The church had been established in 1821 after black Christians left the Methodist Church to form their own congregation. Later, Ellington said that as a young child, he was not aware of any difference theologically between the Baptists and the AME Zion Church. The important thing to him was sharing the religious experience with his mother. He said it gave him an extraordinary feeling of security. His mother would say to him, "Edward, you don't have anything to worry about. Edward, you are blessed." In 1909, when he was 10, the sale of pianos hit an all-time high in the United States. Most middle-class families of the era had a piano in their home. The Ellingtons had two. Daisy Ellington played the instrument quite well. She played popular and semi-classical pieces, and also hymns and ragtime. At the age of 13, Duke got a job as a soda jerk at the Poodle Dog Cafe on Georgia Avenue in Washington. There he composed his first piece. He said, "We had a piano player who was one of the best when he was sober." But that wasn't all that often. When he got to where he couldn't play any better than I could, the boss would throw him out. The boss would take my place behind the soda fountain and have me play the piano. The only way I could learn how to play a tune was to compose it myself and work it up. And the first one was called Soda Fountain Rag. Music took over the teenager's life. And one afternoon, Oliver Perry, a professional pianist, heard Ellington playing. Impressed by what he heard, Perry invited the boy to become a student. Ellington went to Perry's house almost every day. His teacher became what Ellington described as his piano parent. And Oliver Perry allowed Ellington to play piano with his dance band as an apprentice. In 1920, Ellington went to high school in Washington, D.C., and took one music class and got a D. He left high school in 1917, 3 months shy of graduation, and by 1920, his band was playing at Howard Theater in Washington, the nation's first full-size theater built for black audiences and entertainers. Because of Howard University and because of the good pay for teachers in the District of Columbia, during the first 20 years of the 20th century, the Shaw neighborhood of Washington was the center of African-American culture in the United States. In the 1920s, that center of culture shifted from the Shaw neighborhood in Washington to Harlem in New York City. The Harlem Renaissance developed, and Duke Ellington made the decision to move to New York. He developed a 10-piece orchestra that became the house band at the Cotton Club in Harlem, starting in December of 1927. And live radio broadcasts across the nation established Ellington's reputation. He became one of the most successful musicians in the 20th century. He continued to produce qualities of new pieces and suites, including sacred concerts in various cathedrals, and to appear in public until a couple of months before his death from cancer at the age of 75. Let's listen to Satin Doll.
Cigarette holder, which wigs me over her shoulder, she digs me out catting that satin doll. Baby, shall we go out skipping? Careful, amigo, you're flipping. Speaks Latin, that satin doll. She's nobody's fool, so I'm playing it cool as can be. I'll give it a whirl, but I ain't for no girl catching me. Telephone numbers, well, you know, doing my rumbas with Uno. All that and my satin doll. Thank you. nobody's fool, so I'm playing it cool as can be. I'll give it a whirl, but I ain't for no girl catching me. Telephone numbers, well, you know, doing my rumbas with Uno. All that and my satin doll. All that and my satin doll. All that and my satin doll.
In a sentimental mood, a jazz composition by Duke Ellington. Ellington composed the piece in 1935 and recorded it with his orchestra the same year. Now, according to Ellington, the song was born in Durham, North Carolina. He said, now I'm quoting Duke Ellington, do not hold me responsible for some of the language in this quote. We had played a big dance in a tobacco warehouse, and afterward, a friend of mine, an executive in the North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company, threw a party. I was playing piano when another one of our friends had some trouble with two chicks. To pacify them, I composed this there and then with one chick standing on each side of the piano. So if anyone would like to volunteer to stand next to Don.
In a sentimental mood, I can see the stars come through my room. While your loving attitude is like a flame that lights the gloom on the wings of every kiss, drifts a melody so strange and sweet. In this sentimental bliss, you make my paradise complete. Rose petals seem to fall, it's all like a dream to call you mine. My heart's a lighter thing since you made this night a thing divine. In a sentimental mood, I'm within a world so heavenly, for I never dreamt that you'd be loving sentimental me. Petals seem to fall, it's all like a dream to call you mine. My heart's a lighter thing since you make this night a thing divine. in a sentimental mood. I'm within a world so heavenly, for I never dreamt that you'd be loving sentimental me.
James Wesley Bubber Miley was an early jazz trumpeter and cornet player. He specialized in using the plunger mute. He joined Ellington's band in 1923. Early Ellington hits prominently featured Miley's solo work, which he often borrowed from Baptist hymns sung in his church. Many jazz critics considered Miley's music contributions to be integral to Ellington's early success. Miley was a carefree character who struggled with the problem of alcohol abuse. This eventually led to his breakup with Ellington's band in 1929. He died in 1932 at the age of 29. But that gets to the title of our next piece. It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing. It was based on the often stated credo of Bubber Miley. The music was written and arranged by Ellington in 1931. The song became famous. Ellington wrote, as the expression of a sentiment which prevailed among jazz musicians at the time. Probably the first song to use the phrase swing in the title, it introduced the term swing into everyday language. Thank you. Come Sunday was performed as part of the composition Black, Brown, and Beige, a jazz sympathy written by Duke Ellington for his first concert at Carnegie Hall on January 23, 1943. It was dedicated to telling the story of the place of Black slavery and the church in African American history. In the 1960s, Come Sunday was included in his first sacred concert held at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. He also performed the sacred concert at Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York and at Westminster Abbey in London. Ellington called his sacred concerts the most important thing I have ever done. Robert?
If you want to look at the music, turn to 202 in the hymnal. The words will be behind me. And we're going to learn this because we probably don't know it, most of us. We don't get to do it very often. And so let's listen to Don play it one time. Just listen to the tune, and so we'll all learn it together. Then I'll sing it for you, and then we'll all sing it together. I'll do one verse for you. Listen. Ooh, come Sunday, oh, come Sunday, that's the day. Lord, dear Lord above, God Almighty, God of love, please look down and see my people through. I believe that God put sun and moon upon the sky. I don't mind the gray skies, 'cause they're just clouds passing by. Lord, dear Lord above, God Almighty, God of love, please look down and see my people through. Let's all start the beginning. Ooh.
Sunday, oh, come Sunday, that's the day.
Lord, dear Lord above, God Almighty, God of love, please look down and see my people through. Verse 1, I believe.
I believe that God put sun and moon up in the sky.
I don't mind the gray skies, 'cause they're just clouds passing by. Back to Lord, dear God above, mighty God of love,
please look down and see my
people through. Heaven is a goodness time, a brighter light on high. Lord, dear Lord above, God Almighty, God of love, please look down and see my people through. I believe God is now and was and always will be. With God's blessing, we can make it through eternity. Lord, dear Lord above, mighty God of love,
look down and see my people through.
Thank you, Robert. I want to end by thanking this wonderful band for their excellent work. My colleague Mark Morrison Reed wrote, "The central task of the religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each of us to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the church that assures us that we are not struggling for justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential, for alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens, and our strength is renewed."